listening to the Airline Pilot Guy. I'm Captain Jeff, your host. And we're going to talk about all kinds of stuff on today's show. So sit back, relax, and enjoy the flight. Yes, 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 yes. I know it has been some time since I've put out a podcast, and I am sorry for that, but it has been very, very busy. I've been doing a lot of flying. Last year, you may remember, I was, and you may have not been listening to my podcast back then, shame on you, but I did something that I haven't ever done, which was put all my vacation together, and from Thanksgiving, or actually the day before Thanksgiving last year, till after the holidays, and after New Year's Day, I was off that entire time, like five, almost 6 weeks of a vacation. And it was interesting, to say the least. It was kind of weird, actually, not flying for that long, and I thought that it was going to be really odd, and I thought I was going to be really rusty getting back into the cockpit and flying the airplane. But you know what? I think some of the best landings I've had all year were right after that big break. So maybe I should do that a lot more often. But anyway, this year, decided to do a different strategy with my vacations. And I have to say, I don't like the strategy that I use, but I decided to do something a little bit different. And so I do not have any vacation this December, but I'm senior enough on the airplane that I fly that I can be home on Christmas. And actually, flying every day this week, this is the week before Christmas, if you're listening to this after the effect, it's, I've really, you know, racked up a bunch of flying for the month, and I'm basically, full on the 23rd when I get home Friday morning before, Christmas Eve day, and, I'm off for the rest of the month unless I can pick up some overtime flying. And then I have 2 weeks of vacation in January, so potentially after this, not the trip that I'm on, but the next one that I fly, Thursday and Friday, I may not be flying again until mid-January. So, hey, the skies are safe out there, folks, if you want to get your flying in. And speaking of that, I've noticed the past couple of days that things are really picking up. These airports are really getting busy, and I'm seeing a different crowd of folks than I normally see. It's those kind of travelers that you only see maybe once a year, maybe twice a year. I'm not saying anything negative. It's just you can just tell that these are not the business people that you normally see flying this time of year. A lot of people going to fly to different parts of the country or even the world to spend time with family and friends on these holy days. And speaking of that, I was thinking about the fact that when I'm greeting people or saying goodbye to people, I say Merry Christmas and Happy Holidays. And I think that sometimes when you say Happy Holidays to somebody, they think that you're copping out. Oh, yeah, you just don't want to say Merry Christmas. You don't want to offend anybody. Well, no, that's not it at all. Actually, the word holiday, and you may know this, the word holiday, the etymology of the word is from Old English, halideg, halig, which means holy day or Sabbath, and dag, which means day. So when you're saying happy holidays, you're really saying happy holy days. Yeah, I know the secular world has kind of made it into a word that just means you don't have to go to work or you're not going to get mail that day, but it really is more than that. So everybody here listening, happy holidays. And if you're traveling right now, listening to this podcast in the midst of the holiday travel season, and it's really, really busy, just relax and just think about all the fun you're going to have with your family and friends and eating all kinds of great food and opening Christmas presents and Hanukkah presents and whatever kind of presents you're going to be opening. And just think about that and try to get through the travel experience, because I can tell you what, these airplanes are packed to the gills. And, you know, so I feel for you. I really do. So hopefully your experience won't be too bad and you'll enjoy the holiday season and be safe, please. Okay, let's get on with it, shall we? Because, you know, it's been a while since I've done the podcast again, and I have a heck of a lot of things to talk about. In fact, I'm probably not going to be able to get to even half of what I really want to talk about. And I've gotten a bunch of feedback as well. And listen, if you've sent me feedback, I read it. I usually respond to it. If I haven't, it doesn't mean that I haven't read it. It just means that I'm just too busy. And, but I promise you, I will read or, play your feedback eventually. And, so if I didn't play your feedback or read your feedback on today's show, I apologize, but I'll get to it as soon as I can. I promise. Really. No, not the Bad Boys theme. There are so many things I can play that for in this podcast. Let's see, where to start? Okay, well, you know, usually I'm talking about the TSA when I'm playing this Bad Boys theme. And if you work for the TSA and you're listening to this podcast for the first time, I respect the TSA, I really do. They're just some folks in your ranks that sometimes do really questionable things, you know? And I know you know that. And bring everybody down, don't they? But this time, I'm not really talking about the TSA. I'm talking about another branch of the government. And actually, is it a different branch? Or do they fall under the same branch, the Department of Transportation? I know that's not a branch of the government. The Transportation Department, the Department of Transportation, whatever you want to call it. Well, and I really was not sure I wanted to talk about this at all. Here, let me start with doing this.
Tell me, has there been a death in your family? This is funny stuff.
Well, not really that funny. Yeah, the reason why I was kind of hesitant to talk about this is because, in a way, the gentleman that I'm about to talk about is sort of my boss. I mean, not the boss of my company, but the boss of the Federal Aviation Administration, Mr. Jerome Randolph Babbitt, or Randy Babbitt, as we all know him, the FAA administrator, at one time, a long time, ALPA, our pilots union president. Before that, 25-year, I think, Eastern Airlines pilot, has had a great career in the world of aviation, made it to what some would say is the pinnacle of aviation, the administrator, the head chief, the chief honcho of the Federal Aviation Administration. Yes, Randy Babbitt. Unfortunately for Mr. Babbitt, he had a little altercation with the Fairfax City Police a few weeks back. On a Saturday night, he was arrested after being spotted driving on the wrong side of Old Lee Highway, according to the arresting officer. And basically, we don't know exactly what the blood alcohol level is or what was recorded, but let me just put it this way. When his boss, Mr. LaHood, the Department of Transportation chief, found out that his FAA administrator had been arrested for drunk driving and hadn't told the department of this happening, they were not very happy about it. And funny thing is that Mr. Babbitt resigned. Now, I'm not sure exactly, you know, what went down there, but we can all imagine that there were some heads spinning and flying and whatever metaphor you want to use. But anyway, I'm sorry that he did this, and I'm sorry that he lost his job, and I wish him the best, and hope that everything goes well for him and he has a happy holiday season. But anyway, so we have a new FAA administrator, or at least taking over for now until they assign a new one, Michael Huerta. He's in command of the federal agency right now. So anyway, that's a little news about the former administrator of the Federal Aviation Administration. And let's see. Let's talk about the other big person in the news lately. And let me play this little sound clip here.
Elaine, you're a member of this crew. Can you face some unpleasant facts?
No.
Well, the unpleasant fact is that there is a celebrity on our airplane here, American Airlines Flight I don't know what flight it was. And this gentleman, this celebrity, was playing Words with Friends on his electronic device. And you all know we're supposed to turn the darn things off when the forward boarding door is closed and they're getting ready for pushback. And basically this person, Alec Baldwin, was so involved in his game of Words with Friends, kind of like an online interactive Scrabble game, that he refused. And they basically threw him off the airplane after he threw a little temper tantrum. Now, don't get me wrong. I like Alec Baldwin as an actor. As a person, not so much. But as an actor, I think he's really good, especially in his role on 30 Rock. Anyway, so he was escorted off the airplane, and he has some bad things to say about the personnel at American Airlines. And then just recently, I don't know if you guys watched Saturday Night Live, but he was on for a little skit during their little news segment. And I have just a little snippet of this. It was actually pretty funny. Let me play this.
On Wednesday this week, actor Alec Baldwin was kicked off an American Airlines flight after he refused to turn off his phone and stop playing Words with Friends. Now here to comment, the pilot of that flight, Captain Steve Rogers.
Thanks for having me, Seth.
So, Captain Rogers, what's your take on the events of last Wednesday?
Well, it was awful, Seth, which is why it was very important for me to come here tonight and on behalf of everyone at American Airlines issue an apology to Mr. Alec Baldwin.
Alec, are you sure this is the right way to handle this?
Yeah, keep going. Keep going. Okay.
Well, I don't know if that was the right way to handle it or not, but it was funny. I have to admit, they've used that Captain Steve Rogers character, many times, when, Skullenberger or whatever, his real name is, but we call him, you know, Scully, the Miracle on the Hudson, the aftermath of that, they had a Captain Steve Rogers on, played by a different, member of the, Saturday Night Live staff. And he kind of portrayed another airline pilot who was a little disgruntled by the fact that Scully was getting all the all this good press. And anyway, you may have you may remember me playing that little clip several episodes back. Anyway, so yeah, it's kind of funny to use humor to kind of smooth over kind of a sticky situation. Now, electronic devices, you know. Or if you haven't heard this podcast, you may not know, but most everybody knows what my stance is regarding electronic devices. Do I think it makes any difference if 1, 2, 5, 10, the whole darn airplane have their electronic devices on? Personally, my opinion, no, I don't think it matters. And I've said that time after time. In fact, I was asked to be interviewed by a well-known blogger in the aviation world, and during that interview, this person asked me about how I felt about electronic devices and the ban against them. And I told this person that I thought it was kind of ridiculous that we have all this technology, and people in the back, you know, above 10,000 feet, have their laptops on and their iPads and their iPhones. They're tapping into the Wi-Fi system. They're seeing things that we as pilots should be able to access and see ourselves for the safety of the flight, like the bird's eye view of weather radar across the country. A lot of information that we don't have available to us. Well, I mean, it could be, but we don't, because it's not legal for us to have electronic devices on in the cockpit. Now, you wouldn't believe all the negative, nasty comments that I got from people saying they would never fly with a captain like this. And basically, I didn't know what I was talking about. I'm just a dumb pilot. I don't have any education. I don't know nothing about electronics. Well, you know what? Most pilots out there have college degrees, at least bachelor's degrees. Many of us in engineering. Thank you very much. And some have master's and even PhDs. And guess what? We're not, you know, dumb people. We know what we're talking about. Not only do we have our scientific engineering brains backing us up, but we also have our experience with this stuff. And we can tell you, or at least most of us would tell you, that electronic devices don't have any effect whatsoever on anything as far as affecting the safety of the flight. And I was very gratified to see, just recently, you may have heard about this, the FAA has approved iPads in the cockpit. Now, this is not really news. I mean, it was, earlier this year, maybe even at the end of last year, when the fractional jet ownership company, NetJets, appealed to the FAA to use the iPad as an electronic flight kit. And they did extensive testing and determined that this thing worked just fine and doesn't cause a problem at all with the avionics or instrumentation of the airplane. And so they got approval for using it. And so did Alaska Airlines and United Airlines and Acme Airlines. We are in the midst of a program right now where some of the staff of my airline are testing these devices out to be used as electronic flight kits. And but as far as I know, up to this point, it was not allowed to be used below 10,000 feet. Now, I could be wrong about that. I thought that the NetJets approval of iPads in the cockpit were allowed to be used during all phases of flight. And, you know, frankly, if you're a pilot, you know that the greatest, most efficient use of this device is to be able to display the approach plates for the instrument approaches you're flying, the airport diagram that you need to have when you're on the ground, taxiing around, etc. So, yeah, I thought that they were allowed to do that. But according to this article I was reading, it said that they said in this article that American Airlines is the first airline to get approval to operate the iPad device all the way from the ground, all the way through the entire flight. And so no restrictions at all on that. So all I can say to those people who were kind of giving me a bad time about it is, nah, 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 I told you. In fact, I even mentioned in one of my comments to some of these naysayers that not only is it going to happen, but it's going to happen sooner than you think. And so thank you, FAA, for approving this great device for our use. It's going to really be helpful to us pilots. It's going to save a lot of weight. It's going to save a lot of money for the companies and not having to subscribe to all these publications, these paper publications, etc. It's not going to be free or cheap, but it's going to be less expensive. It's going to end up saving the airlines lots of money. And hopefully we'll be able to pass on that savings to you. Either that or pay the pilots more money, which we deserve. Okay, let's see. Where to go next? I'm looking at my Evernote Catholic pilot, airline pilot guy folder. And, what did I want to, oh, this is really interesting. You heard me talk about the Air France flight 447. You know, the one last, well, I guess it was a couple of years ago now, 2009. I think it was in the June of 2009, crashed over the Atlantic Ocean. And for the longest time, there was speculation, about what may have happened. And a great NOVA report, a part of the public broadcasting system in the United States, did a show about the accident. And when these safety effort experts from around the world kind of hypothesized or theorized that what had happened was the freezing over of the pitot tubes, and then manual control of the airplane, and then basically the pilots self-inducing a high altitude, high speed aerodynamic stall. And, of course they found the black boxes, which are not black, earlier this year. And guess what? They were right. That's exactly what happened. It was a perfectly good airplane that, flew right into the, and didn't fly actually. It just fell out of the sky into the Atlantic Ocean, killing everybody on board. So I thought it was interesting. One of the things that really has bothered me for the longest time is, how did they get in that situation to begin with? How is it that all the other flights that night crossing the intertropical convergence zone, which is that area, you know, around the equator, 10 degrees, to the north and 10 degrees to the south, which actually adjusts during the year, whether or not it's, you know, if it's the wintertime or the summertime or whatever. It moves around a little bit, but basically that band of the globe or the area of the globe where you get this convergence of the two hemispheres, you know, the northern hemisphere and the southern hemisphere, and the weather patterns are kind of going in opposite directions. And of course, it's really hot in that area. The oceans are warm, and you get all this convective activity. In other words, thunderstorms and big, pretty violent storms. In fact, the policy for Acme Airlines, and probably for most of the big airlines that fly through that region, is that if you are looking at your forward-looking weather radar and you see even any color at all, whether it be red, yellow, or green even, you stay away from it. You treat it as if that is something you don't want to fly into. So I was scratching my head, wondering how in the world this Air France flight ended up flying into that area. And, you know, because other airlines, other flights had taken a wide berth of these storms that this Air France flight flew almost directly into. And I was looking at this article, and let me see, I'm trying to find it. Here we go. There was a book published not that long ago. It's a French book entitled Erreurs de Pilotage. Now, of course, I don't speak French, and I probably really butchered that, but basically that means Pilot Error, Volume 5, by pilot and aviation writer Jean-Pierre Otelli, which includes the full transcript of the pilot's conversations on Flight 447. And there was a little excerpt, I think this was in Popular Science, Popular Mechanics, that's right. And so I was reading through some of the transcript, and this is something that just really hit me as significant. And let me quote here. In the meantime, Robert, one of the pilots, has been examining the radar system and has found that it has not been set up in the correct mode. Changing the settings, he scrutinizes the radar map and realizes that they are headed directly toward an area of intense activity. Okay, so I think a lot of people could say, and I would say so, that this was the first break in the chain of events, you know, because anytime we have a big accident, it's usually a series of things happening that leads to a tragedy or a disaster. And I think this may be the one of the first things that happened that caused the whole thing to just go downhill. So apparently, according to this transcript, the radar system was not set correctly. You know, this is in the middle of the night. It's dark. I'm not sure if the moon was out or not, but I'm guessing that it was pretty dark and probably not a moonlit night. And they didn't see the huge storm system that they were about to fly into. And then when the more senior first officer examined the radar system, he realized, oops, it's not in the correct mode. And it doesn't say what the correct mode is or what the incorrect mode was. I don't know if they were in map mode or turbulence mode or whatever. But or maybe the tilt of the radar system was up and it should have been down, because when we're climbing out, we generally we can adjust the tilt of our forward looking radar. You know, that nose cone inside of there. If you took the nose cone off of a jet, you'd see one of these little radar antennas, and that thing is moving around, and we can adjust the vertical tilt on it. And when we're, before we take off and as we're climbing out, we set the tilt somewhere around 7 to 10 degrees nose high. And then as we get a little bit higher in altitude, we start lowering it. And up at cruise altitude, it's generally, again, depending on the radar system and the airplane, somewhere around, I don't know, 2 to 5 to 7 degrees down, depending on what you're trying to use your radar for. So anyway, we have a little knob on our radar, control panel that we can adjust the tilt of the radar. So that may have been what was wrong with the setting. Maybe they had the tilt up. They forgot to tilt it down. Or maybe also you can kind of change the, adjust the sensitivity. Sorry about the sibilance there. Adjust the sensitivity of the returns of the radar system. Now, a little aside, jump seating on the Boeing 777, 777, That radar system is just awesome. Very, very sophisticated, and you don't have to adjust it at all. It knows exactly where the airplane is. It knows what the altitude is. It knows exactly how to adjust the tilt of the radar, so pilots don't have to do it manually. Very, very cool. Anyway, who knows exactly what how it was incorrectly set, but that really kind of for me, at least, gives me an idea of how in the world they got into the situation to begin with. And then, of course, once they did lose their airspeed data, and remember, it was only just under a minute worth of losing their airspeed readings, although they probably thought they had lost it for good because they weren't trusting the airspeed indications that they were receiving after they started falling out of the sky. But anyway, I don't want to do a whole show on Air France 447. I've done that on several of the previous episodes. So if you're interested in that, check those out. And also, if you want to look at a fantastic investigation, look up that NOVA episode about the Air France 447. I forget exactly what the title of the program is, but you can probably just do a Google search for NOVA, N-O-V-A, and Air France, AF447. Okay. Had a bunch of feedback. Let's see. Why don't we start with a voice feedback from PJ. And let me click on this and click on this button, and let's hear what PJ has to say.
Hey, Captain Jeff. It's PJ from Houston, Texas again. First off, I want to say thank you so much for a few weeks ago reading the feedback I sent you about the flight simulator stuff. I didn't intend to become the entire podcast with that email, but I guess I did get a little bit long-winded. I wanted to comment real quick this time on your TCAS discussion. You asked if it was required for general aviation. I believe for light aircraft it is not required. However, I think for any aircraft that goes above 25,000 feet or in the RVSM altitude, it is required for those aircraft. The GA aircraft don't necessarily use TCAS, the light GA stuff. Some are equipped with what's called TIS, T-I-S. Traffic Information System. It's kind of similar to TCAS in its display characteristics, where it shows little diamonds on your moving map display with the plus or minus how many hundreds of feet they are from you. But instead of, does not provide resolution advisories. It will warn you if traffic is nearby, but will not provide the resolution advisory itself. That all works off of the MODES transponders, and there's no actual radar on board. It's actually a ground-based system that's feeding information to the aircraft. Anyway, I hope this helps out, and I will look forward to listening to more podcasts. God bless. We'll talk to you later.
Hey, thanks, PJ. And look, he's trying to take over my podcast again. No, I'm just kidding. Thanks for I always appreciate your feedback, PJ. Your feedback? That's something entirely different. Sorry. Anyway, yeah, thanks for getting back to me regarding the whether or not the TCAS systems are required in general aviation aircraft. And I did not know about the TIS system, which uses ground-based components to send the information to the airplanes. But however it's done, I think that it's important to have, even if you don't have the resolution advisory kind of aspect of the device, just knowing where the traffic is around you is really important. And that way you can kind of look out and try to figure out where that traffic is, or, you know, alter your course or whatever, alter your altitude to avoid hitting another piece of metal flying through the sky. So, yeah, thank you again for that feedback regarding TCAS and TIS. I learn something new every day. And somebody sent me this. I apologize. I'm looking at it in my Evernote application, and apparently I clipped this article, but I forgot to attribute to whom sent it to me. So sorry about that. Whoever sent this to me, thank you. Anyway, what am I talking about? It's something called the Strato Launch. It's a Paul Allen. His new venture reunites the Ansari X prize team and adds SpaceX. That's the title of the headline. Strato Launch, is a very, very large airplane. In fact, it looks a heck of a lot to me like the Spruce Goose, that big giant airplane that Howard Hughes designed and flew accidentally on a high-speed taxi test. That's what they want you to believe anyway. Anyway, this thing, it looks a lot like the Spruce Goose, but like two full big giant fuselages, and in between the two fuselages and this very, very long, I think, how big is that wingspan? Let me see. I'm trying to peruse this article really quickly. 385 foot wingspan. That's longer wingspan. That's longer than a football field. 1.2 million pound airplane. 6747 engines. Anyway, between the two fuselages, if you can think of, if you remember that World War II fighter, the P-38 had two fuselages and connected by the wing, and then two tail surfaces. I think they were connected in the back. I think I'm trying to imagine in my head what that looked like. But anyway, it looks a lot like that, except for a lot bigger. And so three 747s on each side of each fuselage. In the middle, this is the critical part of it, is where they would attach a rocket. And so they are thinking that this is going to be a launch system for orbital cargo delivery, and then maybe in the future actually manned spaceflight. So it's going to be the way, perhaps, that we end up launching some of these space vehicles. So I thought that was pretty cool. I'll try to remember to put a link to this article in the show notes. And thank you again to whoever sent this to me. Appreciate it. Let's see. Speaking of feedback, let's listen to some more feedback. This is from Ken Stringer. He is an RJ first officer, a CRJ first officer in Atlanta. And he writes, Captain Jeff, another good show. I just wanted to add a few comments about a couple of other noteworthy spins. Okay, I think it was the last show. Yeah, I was talking about spins. And he's read that the first L-1011 was accidentally entered into a spin during its initial flight testing. And then he gives me a link. And I wonder if this is the same hull that now serves as the gift shop at the Acme Museum in Atlanta. It could be. I don't know. And I did read that, thank you for that article link, Ken, and I read it, and man, I'll tell you what, I've always been impressed. I flew the L-1011 for 3 years as a co-pilot, and I was extremely impressed with the engineering that went into that airplane. It was a very, very rugged, beefy airplane, and I'm amazed at what it went through and how they accidentally got it into the stall/spin and were able to recover the airplane from that spin. And it just gives me more respect for the airplane and for the people who built it and designed it. Okay, he goes on in his feedback. Another noteworthy spin was a Navy P-3 Orion during the summer of 2008. God, that was just a few years ago, folks. I heard about this one only because I'm retired from 20 years of flying around in the back of a P-3 and still know a few people in the community who sent me a few pictures and a brief narrative of what happened. Again, he sends me a link to the narrative about the about this P-3 spin. The pictures that he had, he said that he's not sure if he still has them or not. All it basically showed was some of the over wing skin panels that peeled up where the rivets popped out. It's amazing they didn't crash that. Yeah, here, one of the problems with a spin, folks, if you can actually recover it from the spin, is the actual pullout, the dive recovery that you're going to have to put the airplane through to keep it from hitting the ground. And these airplanes are not stressed. Now, the P-3 is probably stressed to handle more G-forces than, say, an airliner is. But they apparently pulled a few Gs, G-forces, to keep the thing from hitting the ground and recovering. So anyway, and lastly, there are the stories of how barnstorming pilots would sometimes use the spin as a technique to safely get below an overcast layer. Without any gyro instruments, a spin was the only way they could get through the cloud layer without losing control. All this, of course, is assuming there is sufficient room to recover once they broke out. While many would consider a spin an out-of-control event, these pilots saw it as a maneuver that would prevent excessive speed from building up, and keep the aircraft in a fixed stated, I'm not sure if what you mean there, a fixed state, I think. I think there was an extra D in there, sorry. Thereby allowing them to safely descend through an overcast layer. Yeah, I'd heard that too. The early days of flying, the Barnstormers, even folks out there flying the Mail, and I think I even remember reading some stories of some World War I pilots using that same technique by purposely entering into a spin and then getting below that that layer of clouds, and as you said, hopefully having some altitude there to recover from the spin once they pop out of the overcast layer and then proceed visually. But, boy, I tell you what, that's some crazy flying, huh? You know, in a way, I think it would be kind of cool to fly back then, but, in another way, probably would not live very long. So thanks again, Ken, for the feedback. Also, Jen from Northern California, she says, don't try the last name. Just don't. Let's see. I'd be leaving you audio feedback, but it's late. I'm trying not to wake my sleeping toddler. In episode 17, the last episode, you said that my feedback regarding choice of airline had to do with airline loyalty and frequent flyer points. That's not actually the case. Yeah. You know, I told Jen that I was kind of flying by the seat of my pants. I thought that that's what the point that she was making, but, apparently not. I got it wrong. Sorry. So let me continue with her email. That's not actually the case. With me, there are two factors. The first one is expediency. In the last 9 years, I've lived in places where the airport is 2 hours away and where a very small selection of carriers fly. Given the choice between several carriers, I will usually choose the one that will get me to where I need to go in the shortest amount of legs. Given that my destination is generally Seattle, I tend to fly Horizon in rural areas, Alaska from larger airports, and sometimes American if Alaska can't get me there. The other factor is help when I'm flying alone with my son. United has been absolutely horrible in that respect, while Horizon, Alaska, and American have bent over backwards to help me out with getting him on off the plane, gate checking car seats or strollers, and generally helping me out. Just wanted to make this clear. Okay. And I'd just like to make a point right there. You know, people talk about the horrible flight that they had on XXX airline. Oop, that's not appropriate. Let's say Acme airline, my airline. I just had a horrible flight. I'll never fly Acme again because the crew was so rude to me. They didn't help me or blah, blah, blah. Or the pilots didn't say a word, or they wouldn't stop talking, or they got into this turbulence that just scared the heck out of me, and I'm never going to fly that airline again. Well, you know what? It happens at every airline. You're going to have experiences which are just absolutely wonderful. Couldn't have been done better. You're going to meet people that are the nicest people you've ever met in your life, and then you're going to have the other experience, most likely, if you fly enough. So please don't judge. I know I'm the same way. We're all humans. We tend to make value judgments on brief exposures and you know, kind of snap judgments and such. So, you know, give these airlines a chance and give them the benefit of the doubt. But if you fly a lot, as Jen does, perhaps it's a recurring theme and maybe just a general, atmosphere of a particular airline. And that may be true. I'm not saying you're wrong, Jen. I'm just saying, we need to, understand that you may get a bad experience with a particular airline, and it may not be that way all the time. But anyway, this is Jen speaking again. Given that I used to work in the area of the U.S. Customs on U.S.-Canada border when I lived in Montana, I can tell you a bit about pre-clearance in airports and travel in general. The Western Hemisphere Travel Initiative was enacted as a provision of the Intelligence Reform and Terrorism Prevention Act of 2004. Whew, that's a mouthful. And put into effect in 2007. At that point, all travelers from the U.S. and Canada were required to have a passport to travel back to the U.S. from places in the Western Hemisphere by air. Other provisions were enacted later, which required specific documents to be presented when entering the U.S. by land and sea. And she gives me a link to a government website in case you're interested. For example, I had to get a passport or a Nexus card in 2009 if I wanted to drive across the border crossing to the sandwich shop on the other side in Alberta. And yes, the border guards had a laugh over the fact that we were leaving the country for lunch. Boy, they must have been good sandwiches. There are also special programs for those who travel across the border frequently by land, but this is an aviation podcast, so I'll skip those. Thank you. In terms of preclearance, you are right in that only certain airports in certain countries have that privilege, and it's relatively new in Ireland. I know that we had to do U.S. Customs in Chicago when I was returning from Ireland 13 years ago. So I looked it up, and it's been in effect at Shannon since 2009 and Dublin since 2011. As far as Canada, I had the experience of going through it in Toronto in 97 and again in 2002. From what I remember, we had to fill out our I-94 on site and go through all the questioning at the airport. Okay, well, I'm going to it's a long email. Thanks for the feedback, Jen. She puts a link to the list of places where it's in effect, and I basically covered them all. But, generally speaking, Ireland, many of the big airports in Canada, and also in the Bahamas and the Caribbean. So some of the places, not all. Let's see. Oh, and she ends with talking about the terminal at the Seattle-Tacoma International Airport. One of her favorites is this airport, considering the large amount of time she spent there over my, or time I've spent there over my lifetime, as most of my extended family is in Washington. The new central terminal opened around 2004, and it has a number of shops, restaurants, and huge windows where you can watch planes take off and land. Given that I'm the granddaughter of a pilot, I'm always trying to find a table near the window so I can watch the action outside while noshing on some Qdoba. This is also where I watched most of the 2010 Super Bowl as they were broadcasting it throughout the airport. As usual, love the show. It gives me something peaceful to listen to during my son's naps and when I'm trying to fall asleep at night. Yes, I've been told, Jen, thank you very much, many times that my voice puts people to sleep. So I'm glad that I could help in that matter. And thank you for your feedback. Always appreciated. Always appreciated. And thanks for your vote for one of the popular airports out there, Seattle-Tacoma International. And it's set in a beautiful part of the country, that's for sure. I love the Pacific Northwest. Hope to get out there again sometime soon. Okay, good friend of mine, a fellow podcaster, Daniel Smrakowski. He does a podcast called Special Chronicles. Daniel suffers from a disability, a speech disability. And he is a heavily involved in the Special Olympics, hence the name Special Chronicles podcast. And he's one of the ambassadors for the Illinois Special Olympics. He's a participant in the Special Olympics, and he goes out there speaking about it and talking about disabilities and such. Great podcast. You should check it out. Again, that's specialchronicles.com. Dan is doing something new in January. I'm not sure what it is. He's going to partner with somebody or affiliate with somebody. I'm not sure. He hasn't told me. But something is new. Something new is coming up in Dan's podcast. And let's see. You can find it at specialchronicles.com. And what else was I going to say? Well, he sent me some email. Just read this news article on disabilityscoop.com, and it relates to airlines and specifically the TSA. I thought you may be interested in commenting on it on your Airline Pilot Guide podcast. Looking forward to hearing what you think of the article. And here's a little excerpt from the article. As the holiday season heats up, the Transportation Security Administration is preparing to launch a toll-free hotline for passengers with disabilities. But at least one lawmaker is calling for the agency to do more. Senator Charles Schumer, Democrat New York, wants the TSA to designate passenger advocates at every airport to address concerns and help travelers with special needs. The request comes after a number of complaints from elderly women in recent weeks. In multiple cases, women alleged that TSA agents subjected them to strip searches because they were wearing specialized medical devices. Here's a quote from Schumer. While the safety and security of our flights must be a top priority, we need to make sure that flying does not become a fear-inducing, degrading, and potentially humiliating experience. Right now, passengers who feel that their rights are about to be violated have nowhere to turn. but by training passenger advocates at each of our airports, the TSA can finally give passengers a choice. So that's just a part of the article. I'll try to include a link to disabilityscoop.com where they talk about this article. And I think it's a great idea. Yeah, we have to remember that not everybody has the same abilities, and it can be intimidating to go through security for anybody, really. But if you have a disability, especially so. So I think that's a good thing. So thanks, Dan, for sending that to me. Appreciate it. And again, check out Daniel's podcast, specialchronicles.com. Liz sent me some feedback, and let's see. She says she just finished listening to Airline Pilot Guy number 17. With the opening of the new terminal T2 in Dublin, you clear U.S. Customs and Immigration in Ireland. It's a very cool process. They show you images of checked baggage for you to claim. Overhead on the wall, photos of U.S. President and two others and U.S. flags. Once cleared, you go through a second screening and bags x-rayed process. I assume U.S. agents. Yes, she assumes that they are U.S. agents because you are now considered on U.S. property. Once we landed at JFK and collected bags, we walked right out with other domestic flights to get our ride home. It was fantastic. Well, thanks for the feedback. I asked everybody out there that if they had experience with the pre-clearance, what they thought about it. And Liz is a happy customer. So thanks, Liz, for sending the feedback. I appreciate it. Okay, Steve, another good friend of mine, a fellow member of the StarQuest Production Network community, Steve Robichaud, sent me this email. On the morning of Friday, December 2nd, a small private airplane crashed into a residential neighborhood here in Midland, Texas. The plane was a King Air F-90, which a pilot friend here in Midland tells me is a twin-engine turboprop with a seating capacity of 7 people. The plane and one house were completely destroyed, and significant damage was done to several more houses. The pilot, the only occupant of the plane, was rescued with non-life-threatening injuries, and the lady who lived in the house was not seriously injured. Midland's weather on that day was cloudy with a low ceiling and light fog and drizzle, ground air temperature hovering around freezing. And then he gave me a couple links below to some news reports, local news reports of the incident. I watched them and read them, and weren't a lot of details at the time because they had just come out shortly after the crash. And the article continues. Oh, I'm sorry. No, Steve continues. According to news reports, the pilot claimed to have attempted a landing at Midland Air Park, a small civil airfield administered by the city of Midland, when he aborted the landing because he could not see the runway. Coming around for a second attempt at landing, he lost control of the airplane. My pilot friend tells me that planes of this type, which frequent Midland Air Park, usually come from the Houston area, at an altitude of 20,000 feet above the weather where the air temperature is minus 20 degrees Fahrenheit, and then they drop down really fast to land. An airframe at minus 20 degrees in that weather, he says, could build up half an inch of ice in no time. Your perspective would be much appreciated. Your friend in Texas, Steve. Thanks, Steve, for the feedback. As far as your pilot friend, and talking about the ice, well, ice, you know, it's formed in very specific conditions. And just because you have an airframe that's cold or super cooled and it goes through, an air mass that might have some precipitation in it, doesn't necessarily mean that it's going to build up a half an inch of ice. It's possible, but I think from what I have read and could find out about this accident, I don't think that icing played a part at all in this case. And the King Air F-90, I would think, it's a sophisticated airplane. I'm sure it has some, at least some ice boots on it to keep the ice buildup from affecting the aerodynamics of the airplane. If you're out there, have flown the King Air F-90 or any of the King Air series or any kind of medium-sized turboprop, let me know what you think about this. But I did some research and went to the NTSB site to see if there was any kind of an NTSB report, and couldn't find anything at all, nothing. And I've done some subsequent searches regarding this accident, and again, squat, nothing. So I don't know what happened there, but I'm glad that nobody was killed, either the pilot flying or lady whose house he crashed into. So it could be just a case of being a little bit frazzled that after flying an instrument approach, could not see the runway, had to do a go-around, which is a pretty stressful procedure, and then maybe got distracted with something and somehow lost control of the airplane. I don't know. It's just all pure speculation on my part. I have no idea. If you hear something, Steve, please send me some feedback. Let me know if they've found out anything else about this accident. Okay. Again, just looking through my list. Oh, I need to do this. Let's see. I'm about 50 minutes into the podcast, so I'm going to try to keep it under an hour so you all can enjoy your Christmas time. The end of Advent, Christmas, Hanukkah, Kwanzaa, whatever it is you celebrate. I got some feedback from Albert in Miami. And let's see. Dear Captain Nielsen, I'm a 14-year-old Cessna pilot from Miami, Florida. I started to listen to your podcast about 2 weeks ago and has honestly changed my perspective on not only aviation, but my faith. I am a fellow Catholic myself, and seeing an airline captain who relates to me is very rewarding. I wish to study at Purdue and one day land a job at one of the legacy carriers here in the United States. I really enjoy hearing the latest headlines in aviation on your podcast, and by far my favorite podcast of yours was your story on flying with a captain and flying with a good captain. If you could please do more podcasts about airline stories at Acme, I'd really appreciate it. Yeah, I need to do that more. Albert, you're right. Okay, back to his feedback. If you could please do more. Oh, I just read that sentence. Sorry. Besides that, your podcast is the best available. Well, thank you. You have served as an honest inspiration to me to excel and better myself as a pilot and human being. In your latest podcast, you mentioned favorite airports, and since I am from Miami, could you please go over KMIA, which is the Miami International Airport, and any stories associated with the airport? I'd like to contact you later to ask you some questions about flying for an airline. Many thanks and blessings, Albert. And that's Albert Rodriguez, General Aviation Pilot, Cessna 172 in Miami. First of all, Albert, thanks for sending me the feedback. It's really encouraging for me to know that there are people your age. You know, you're my daughter's age. My youngest is 14. She's almost 15, going on 25, I think. But anyway, you seem like a very mature young man and sounds like you know what you want. Reminds me of myself at your age, actually. And maybe the same is true for you. I kind of knew back when I was about 7-8 years old that I wanted to be an airline pilot for my job when I grew up. And sounds to me like you're going to follow the same path, which is fantastic. And I would just contact me anytime you want about questions for flying for an airline. As an aside, I know many of you have asked and inquired about how to get to where I am in the airline industry. And as many of you know, I kind of came through the military system. However, that is not the only way to get here. In fact, it's probably not even the way a majority of people are getting into the airlines these days. So I've been trying to talk with guys I fly with, guys and girls, but mostly guys, about how they got to where they are. And interestingly, the co-pilot that I'm flying with on this trip came through a kind of a special program, a very fast track kind of a program, and he was hired with a very, very little time by a regional airline and flew there for, I think, 4 years or so before he was hired by Acme. And now he has, let's see, he's only in his mid-30s, so he's got, 25 years or so left in his airline career. So it's going to be great for him. His timing is fantastic. And if you're 14 years old or younger and you're interested in aviation, it's a great time for you to get into the industry as well. I think that there are nothing but good things to come in flying for especially the legacy of the big airlines. Anyway, so my point about talking about my co-pilot and different routes to get to where I am in this job is that I'm doing my best to get as much information about that as possible so that I can pass that on to you. And I hope to interview this gentleman before I finish the trip tomorrow. May not happen though. Of course, we're probably not going to have time tomorrow for this, but I'll try to get an interview with him, and he can tell you about how he made it to Acme Airlines. So, Miami International. And also Albert, I agree. I need to talk a little bit more about stuff going on at my airline, my big legacy airline, and experiences I've had, especially, the same type of stories as, you know, the good captain, bad captain, or whatever I called that show. I'm interested in that as well. So I will do that, definitely. So thanks for your feedback, Albert. And let me talk a little bit about Miami International Airport. It, according to the Wikipedia Free Encyclopedia, was or started off as Wilcox Field. Let's see. Is that the way it started off? Okay, I'm trying to. I read this article a while back, and now I'm kind of perusing it very quickly to see. Yeah, it says that historically it was called Wilcox Field, primary airport serving the South Florida area. The airport is an unincorporated area of Miami-Dade County, about 13 kilometers northwest of downtown Miami in metropolitan Miami, between the cities of Miami, Hialeah, Doral, Miami Springs, and the village of Virginia Gardens and unincorporated Fontainebleau. The airport is a hub for passenger airlines, American Airlines, Executive Airlines under the American Eagle name, several cargo airlines. If you've ever flown into Miami International, huge cargo operation for Central and South America. Let's see, UPS, FedEx, charter airline Miami Air, and a whole bunch of as I said, Central and South American airlines, especially the cargo carriers. Miami International is the largest gateway between the United States and Latin America, and is one of the largest airline hubs in the United States, owing to its proximity to tourist attractions, local economic growth, large local Latin American and European populations, and strategic location to handle connecting traffic between North America, Latin America, and Europe. In the past, it's been a hub for Braniff International, Eastern, Air Florida, and National Airlines, and the original Pan Am, United Airlines, and Iberia. Okay, let's see. Let's talk a little bit about its history here. No. It first opened in 1928 as Pan American Field, the operating base of Pan American Airways Corporation on the north side of the present-day modern airport property. After Pan Am acquired the New York, Rio, and Buenos Aires line, it shifted most of its operations to the Dinner Key seaplane base, leaving Pan Am Field largely unused until Eastern Airlines began flying there in 1934, followed by National in 1937. Worked at an FBO, a fixed base operation in Mobile for many of my high school summer breaks, and even while I was in college, when I came home for summer and Christmas breaks. And one of the things that we did at the Mobile Air Center was we had a contract with fueling a couple different airlines that came through Mobile at the time, called Bates Field, now called Mobile International, I think, or Mobile Regional, one or the other. And one of the things we did was, you know, provided fuel services for what was it called? Texas International. They flew the little nines, and National Airlines, and they came through Mobile with the 727s. And so that brings back some memories when I see National Airlines. Anywho, getting back to the article about Miami International Airport, let's see. In 1945, the city of Miami established a port authority and raised bond revenue to purchase the airport, which had meanwhile been renamed 36th Street Airport. So, started off as Pan American Field and then 36th Street Airport. Boy, I've never heard of an airport named that or anything like that before, have you? Kind of weird. Let's see. I guess there was a lot of military activity as well. Air Force Reserve Troop Carrier and Rescue Squadrons also operated from Miami International from 1949 through 1959, when the last such unit relocated to nearby Homestead Air Force Base, and now Homestead Air Reserve Base. Okay, well, a lot more information about the Miami International Airport on this Wikipedia article. And it basically, the layout, it's a very large airport, a lot of very long runways. You know, these international air carriers, especially the big cargo jets carrying lots of weight, need a huge, long runway to take off on. And I believe the longest one is runway 27 left, 9 right. And I'm just going from memory now, but I think that it is about 13,000 feet long, which is about 3,962 meters. And it's a great runway to land on. You got lots of room to fudge a really, really nice landing. Then you can just nicely decelerate as you take one of the numerous high-speed taxiway exits on that runway. And then for Acme Airlines, our terminal is located in the southern part of the terminal area. So you just roll right across the diagonal runway and right on into the gate area. My impression of Miami International, it's a great airport, bustling, very busy airport as far as the terminals are concerned. Let's see, it's easy to spot, although, I believe it's, is it Tamiami or is it, I'm mispronouncing that, Tamiami or, Miami Executive. There's an airport that, or Opa-locka, one of the three that I just mentioned, is nearby Miami International. Same layout. It's sometimes easy to mistake for Miami International, but it's not quite as big. But if you have your instrumentation dialed up correctly and you're paying attention to it, chances are you're not going to land at the wrong airport. I like flying into Miami. Good food there. If you have time to go through security and hit one of the little Cuban coffee shops and get, what do they call that? The cafe cubano, lovely, dark, deep, strong espresso coffee, with a huge amount of sugar. I don't know how they put so much sugar in it. Somehow they get it all in that little tiny cup and it's heaven. Coffee and sweet goodness all in a tiny little cup. Cafe cubano. Anyway. I digress. It's a nice airport. One of the biggest ones, a lot of, people flying in and out of it every year. And, it's one of my favorites. I don't really have any problems with it. The only potential problem that I can see with that airport is that, it's in South Florida, which is in a kind of a tropical environment. So, anywhere from mid, spring through the summer, through the early fall, and sometimes even this time of year, in the wintertime, you'll have convective activities, thunderstorms and stuff. And I hate thunderstorms. So that's the drawback of flying to Miami and Fort Lauderdale, Hollywood, and a lot of those airports in South Florida, is you have to contend with Mother Nature. But generally speaking, it's the kind of convective activity that kind of goes through and doesn't last a long time. And if they have to shut down the airport for a short period of time, that's okay. You usually have enough fuel to hold and wait it out and then come back in. Air traffic controllers are great. They're very experienced with dealing with airplanes, deviating around bad weather and such. So I like it. I'll always enjoy my Miami layovers. So thanks again, Albert, for suggesting that I talk about Miami International. If you have any reflections on the airport or anything else, send it in to me. Appreciate it. Okay. Let's see. How are we doing here? I think that's about it. I think I've hit all the things I wanted to talk about here. Let me look at my little piece of paper that I actually scribbled some things on. Oh, one last thing. Speaking of Pan Am, and I've talked about this in, earlier podcasts where, somebody had sent in some feedback, I don't know, last year, I think, talking about the fact that ABC was going to do, and I think Sony Pictures, going to do a show called Pan Am. And, I think you've heard me talk about it a little bit. I, am one of the hosts or co-hosts. Excuse me. I am one of the co-hosts on, a show on SQPN called The Secrets, or just plain old Secrets of Pan Am, part of our Secrets series, where we talk about, you know, we kind of break apart the episode and the characters and the storyline, and I'm there to basically throw cold water on almost every aspect of the technical details of flying 707s and flight crews and that kind of thing. But it's fun. It's a fun show. If you're watching it and you're interested in hearing what people like us think about. We have a flight attendant, Marcia, that joins us. She's also with Acme Airlines. And Father Roderick, our host, and he's the head honcho at SQPN in Holland, in the Netherlands. And he knows a lot about dramas and television productions. In fact, he's kind of a television and radio celebrity in his own right in his country, in the Netherlands. And anyway, it's a fun show. Check it out, Secrets of Pan Am. And you can find that by going to panam.sqpn.com or doing a Google search for Secrets of Pan Am or finding us on iTunes. Check us out. And finally, you too can send feedback. Remember that most of this show involves what you have to say about stuff and your questions and your comments. And you can do that by sending it to feedback@airlinepilotguy.com. Or better yet, record yourself. Use that smartphone, use your tape recorder, whatever you want to use, and make an MP3 file and attach it to an email and send it to feedback@airlinepilotguy.com. And that's always more interesting than hearing me read your email. Also, you can call my feedback line, my Airline Pilot Guy feedback line, which is 304-99-PILOT, 304-997-4568. That's a West Virginia area code. No, I do not live in West Virginia, but it was the only one that I could find that I could have a cool number like 99-PILOT. So give it a call, leave your feedback, your message, and I'll play it on the show, and you can hear your own voice. So anyway, until we meet again, wishing you blue skies, unlimited visibility, and tailwinds, unless you're landing. And also, again, wishing you a safe, warm, and memorable holiday season. Merry Christmas, take care, and God bless.